Capital and the New History of Outsourced Labor, she examines the ongoing legacies of colonial biopolitics in contemporary transnational Indian labor markets. So thanks for accepting our conversation, our invitation, and a few practicalities. The conversation will last about 50 minutes in total, and there will be the opportunity to ask questions at the end. It will be in English, and we advise you to wear headphones also because of the acoustics in the hall. So without further ado, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a bit strange to have half of the audience behind us, but we'll manage.
I'll tell you if they make funny signs.
Okay. Chris and I spoke beforehand and agreed that we'll each make a fairly brief background statement to give you a sense of our research interests and our experience. And then we'll ask one question of each other. And then we want to speak with the audience, so we may ask you questions after that. So I'll begin. My past research, both the book that was mentioned in the introduction, but also since then, has been focused on care as a form of work, and also things like the investment of attention, of nurture, as resources that are of a concern, particularly to feminists, and are often overlooked as a focus within studying labor. And because the focus of our conversation is thinking about social reproduction, I'm taking up a conversation we had yesterday in the Nation session about care and elaborating on it a little bit this afternoon. So particularly the markets in care that I'm interested in are those that are transnationalized. And so in the US, this is described as the outsourcing of care labor. And I'm interested in both the sorts of destabilizing effects that the outsourcing of care work has on the bourgeois family, but I'm also interested in how it continues histories of exploitation that we can track in histories of colonialism and also in domestic histories, at least in the United States, of the exploitation of the labor of women of color and immigrants. And I think that this interest in new socialities of care, for me, both in the kinds of collectives, formal and informal, that arise out of shared care, but also those that come through digital technologies, are an interest that Chris and I share. So I'm hoping we can talk about that after the background statements. So I'm going to start out with something that Margaret Thatcher said in 1987. And I think it encapsulates what's now being understood to be something of a crisis for the social welfare state, but has actually been, it's not a new crisis. She says in 1987, quote, "There is no such thing as society. There are individual women and there are families," end quote. Sorry, there are individual men and women. I wish she is. There are individual men and women and there are families, end quote. Okay, so that's the extent of the population of the earth. And yesterday I spoke extensively about how the heteropatriarchal nuclear family form, the middle class white, unmarked white family form, is a fairly recent invention, and how it wasn't until the early to mid 20th century in the United States that this becomes the privileged site of recognition, of recognizing citizen subjects. So the family becomes the site, the premier site through which people can access the rights of the citizen, but also the protections of the social welfare state, which, as we're saying, they're being retracted, but this is still a privileged site. And one thing that's interesting about this new, we could say, or maybe not so new, neoliberal economic pressure on the social welfare state is that it's putting pressure on the household. As an economic unit, which in interesting ways is destabilizing the family as a privileged site. But then, of course, those who have the resources are outsourcing the work that made the nuclear family seem stable, seem comprehensible. That work is being outsourced now transnationally. But I would argue that, at least in the United States, that work has always been outsourced by women who could afford to hire out the work of reproducing the household. So for me, the reproduction of the state has everything to do with the household unit and its work of reproducing itself. But that work has, the household has always been a site where the family requires all of this external support. And what happens with the outsourcing of care work, and for me, I'm also interested in transnational surrogacy markets, so not just care work in the sense of domestic work, but also the work of sexual reproduction, gestation, childbirth. When we see it being outsourced, we see it suddenly as a market, and it makes us see this family unit as actually requiring labor that was more easily made invisible in the past. So it sort of gives the lie to the comprehensiveness of the family as a simple economic unit. So one of the things that I'll bring up later, and I think Chris and I both want to discuss with you, the audience, is the question of what types of communities of care or what formations of responsibility could arise out of this retraction of the social welfare state. So, and I think for both of us, this is absolutely a question of race, gender, and sexuality. So can we see this crisis or this destabilizing of the social welfare state as both a symptom of the failure of the nation state, but also as a site of possibility to interrupt what seems like the easy reproduction of the nation, but as we agreed in the nation panel yesterday, has always been a struggle. So I want to think about, through this research on the work of outsourcing care, I want to think about this longer history of how race, gender, and coloniality naturalize where we look for care labor, and it also naturalizes the fact that we think that care labor is disposable, it's unskilled, it's cheap. Meanwhile, workers who are doing domestic work, who are taking care of families who are acting as gestational surrogates, are doing this essential work not just to reproduce the family, but also to reproduce the nation. So how can we look at the people who are doing this work and see what kind of changes they're demanding or what kind of political action they're demanding as a way to inform, at least for me, someone who's not doing this work as my profession? So I also wanted to mark that the kinds of forms of protest that might arise out of a site where someone's doing care work won't necessarily look like the topic we were asked to talk about, which is anti-racism and anti-sexism. So it's not so simply that we can say here is, you know, this is a form of recognizable protest. And so I wanted to encourage us to think about forms of protest that don't look like they're challenging the nation, but maybe do. And maybe one last thing. Yeah, maybe I'll just pause there and say that one of the things I'm interested in talking about with you later is you write about queer communities of care, and I think this is a subject of mutual interest. So maybe we can continue that after your...
Yeah, I'd like that. So thanks. And I want to start my statement by focusing on the role of social reproduction in contemporary Black and queer activism. So in activist context, the first question is always, can you hear us, actually? You can. Okay, because here it's a little different. It's a little weird for us to sit here in this center. All right, so one of the starting points for also the publishing collective, Kitchen Politics, that I'm a part of, was to look at the historical materialist feminism of the 1970s, as a point of departure. And what interested us was their theorization of reproduction as a precondition for capitalist production, right? So the basic idea is houseworks feeding the male workforce, feeding the capitalist machinery. So they put that first. They challenged the boundaries between production, questions of production and reproduction on the one hand, and on the other, between public and private concerns. Traditionally, of course, the public sphere being the space for contestation, deliberation, politics, basically, and the private as this dark space of the household where nothing really seemed to happen. So they challenged that, of course. And one of the campaigns they did, Wages for Housework, that became really famous, was derived out of that discussion. So from that starting point, there has been this development or this common approach in feminist and queer theories to kind of dissolve and even dismiss that distinction between the private and the public. And what I want to do is try to rethink the public starting from that discussion, to rethink the public as networked and being driven by all kinds of affective dynamics. So to rethink the public as affective publics, basically. And within these contexts that I call affective networks, I want to just briefly mention two examples. And one is self-organized communities of care, what we will discuss as communities of care for those affected, for instance, by neoliberal austerity policies after 2011. But also, since we're in Berlin, to mention just at least one local example, the International Women's Space in Berlin-Kreuzberg that derived out of the refugees movement and is, I think, a very interesting example that we can also later discuss. So this is one aspect, one example, but the other more common and mainstream example is, of course, social media as an effective network. So you can already guess that effective networks is not a normative concept, it's just there, it's just happening all the time, for better or worse. There's all these networked algorithmic distortions of reality. We know the viral hate comments that often are directed against people of color, against women, against LGBT people. So, having said that, I'm still kind of skeptic about the, well, hegemonic, maybe even left-wing skepticism towards those activities on social media. You know, dismissing it as a sort of pseudo activity, as clicktivism, and all these descriptions, because I think mainly they're articulated by hegemonic subjects, bourgeois, male, you name it, cis, white subjects, who just do not depend existentially as much on these. Spheres and effective networks than other marginalized subjects, for instance, disabled people or queers in rural areas. For them, it's just a matter of social life and death, basically. Okay, so I wouldn't dismiss this skepticism. I wouldn't dismiss that social media activism within these effective networks. And just mention one more brief example. Black Lives Matter. You probably all know it. It was founded on Facebook and Twitter, mainstream capitalist platform infrastructures, by queer feminists of color. They developed a grassroots infrastructure. It's not just about lighting up the city. It is about founding a pretty stable infrastructure of counter-surveillance. So there's all these new documentaries that imply that as soon as police in certain areas of the U.S., as soon as police cars arrive at a scene, there is at least 10 people pulling out their phones instantly. And that is a stable infrastructure that is there to stay, luckily. So we should think of those examples, even though I am aware that most of the time social media can really suck. Okay, so to come to an end for my first introductory statement, I think these what I call effective networks are heterogeneous infrastructures of social reproduction. They're not publics themselves, but they're the structure out of which publics can emerge, and they do that all the time. And by rethinking these affective network publics and activism in the context of social reproduction, we can think along the lines of materialist feminism and challenge both the certain Marxist threat that focuses on production, as well as the liberal notions of the public as just, you know, the sphere of deliberation and rationality and reason. And I think that could be a useful way of rethinking activism, and especially in regards to queer feminist and people of color activism, because we kind of know that we are dependent on these collective infrastructures in order to attack the existing society. So that's it for now.
Yeah, maybe I should ask you the question.
Okay.
That you said you might pursue, which is this common interest we have in what care can do politically. And a lot of people object to the phrase care or the word care. It sounds too soft for them. It sounds sentimental. It sounds like anti-feminist in some way, but I think both of us have an investment in the political economy of care. So would you be willing to talk a bit more about communities of care and how, what
yes,
that means?
Of course. So communities of care, I mean, it's even in the German word Fürsorge, it has extreme paternalistic connotations, and historically is a very conservative concept, even worse than in English. Mm-hmm. But for us, it was important to address these issues. And one of the historical examples or even models for us was the emergence of the early AIDS crisis in the 1980s, because it was both about militant forms of activism, but at the same time, they developed rather very quickly, actually, functioning infrastructures for safer sex education, adapting to these new situations. They did the basic research, medical research, and they took care of their people. And those who did take care were not exclusively, but very importantly, lesbian feminists who overcame at that point the still pretty strong separatism and identitarian activism and the separation between gay male communities and lesbian feminist communities. So I think that's still a very rich example that somehow also may inspire and has inspired local projects that I know in Berlin. And I bet there's more there are several people here who know that much better than I do myself. But just to give more brief examples, and then we might make sense out of that collectively. I mentioned the International Women's Space. There's a trick for trans interqueer, a project in Berlin. There's an office for the LGBT refugees, and these are just brief examples. But I thought about them because they also point to potential pitfalls And in thinking about these communities of care, some of them are grassroots entirely, some of them are state-funded, and some of them are initiated by state agencies. And if I was talking about, also with the historical reference, about self-organizing, that's always great, but it also helps, it also connects perfectly to the neoliberal measures and policies that you have mentioned earlier. So that's just, I mean, that's not a real answer, it's just a list of projects, but maybe it helps us to think the variety of communities of care, at least the way I was thinking about that earlier. I'm sure you have also a thought on that and how you would maybe more analytically define that notion. Even, I mean, I'm using it, but I can't really give you a precise answer.
No, I think it's actually something, and then maybe we can turn it over to the audience to contribute. But I was going to say that one analytical concept that's been really useful for me is this postcolonial and feminist scholar Gayatri Spivak's notion of affectively necessary resources, and she's thinking about the same feminist materialist that you're talking about in a sort of critical yet sympathetic way. Mm. And her argument is that social life, the reproduction of social life as an economy, requires affective resources that traditional political economy ignores. And so instead of arguing for wages for housework, for example, she would say that what's being produced by this kind of, the affect being produced exceeds anything that you could really realize monetary, because it's doing so much more than just the hour of work that you're doing, right? It's reproducing society, it's reproducing individual life. But in terms of the politics of how we make a decision of where to invest that energy, I think that's a really important question. And yesterday we were talking about family as ideology, household as economic unit. So family as ideology tells us put your, you know, affective resources here, not here, and the communities you're talking about. And maybe we can also talk with the audience about the idea of community and versus collective versus coalition, like, yes, what are the various promises there?
Because I mix it all up.
No, but just thinking about affect, for better or worse, as an economy forces us to also be responsible for how we invest it. And I think that's something I'm interested in talking to people about. So maybe we can pause and talk to the audience. Did you want to ask? You said you wanted to ask people if they knew Berlin's specific examples.
I mean, just feel free to raise your hand or to just yell, but otherwise, maybe you have also questions for the audience? Or
it can seems just see like, if people want to participate for a moment. I can't.
I mean, we could do this forever.
Yeah.
but it would be much more fun to open up.
There's one.
I have a question that has to do with this notion of queer communities of care, and you mentioned the AIDS crisis as an example of sort of counter models, but it seems like you could argue that the crisis in some ways has been averted for white middle-class men and continues to be a permanent crisis for, in particular, black communities. So I kind of have two questions. One is an issue that already came up in the 80s was gender. So lesbians were taking care of gay men, but would the opposite thing have happened? And in the US, you still have those alternative structures among the black gay community, but black women, black straight women, are of course another group that is very much affected by HIV and AIDS, and they can really draw on that same kind of support structures because they are the ones who have to offer the support. And the other question is, of course, around same-sex marriage and the idea, just very basically reflecting what Crenshaw defined as, or one of the examples she used to to explain intersectionality is the idea that people who are somewhat different are in the basement, stand of each other's on each other's shoulders, and if you are different in one way, say you're white, cis, male, but you're gay, and then you are being pulled up, you close the door for the others. And it seems like this alternative structure that was also created by white gay men has now been abandoned for the inclusion in that very traditional family nation model. Do you have any ideas around how these alternative structures can be something other than a necessary reaction to a really deathly crisis and then get folded back into this? We all try to become as bourgeois as possible so that we have access to resources.
Yeah. Mm. I think that was a very apt description of what happened, and it's particularly in the U.S. and in metropolitan areas like New York or L.A. So I would definitely not counter your argument. But what I was interested in more was to take that historical case, let's call it a case, historical case, as a model for rethinking political activism. Right, so I would not doubt that those things happen, but at the same time, it shouldn't be the reason to disregard or to ignore those models. And what I just pointed to was really the brief, rather positive aspect of it. But there were these other aspects too, and we could multiply in terms of the problems that happened in that historical moment in time. We should do that maybe when we have more time. But I am really interested in moments of crisis where politics with capital P, right? The major questions and people coming together and exceeding their boundaries and their separations for that moment. And after that, whatever, you know, other things happen. People just want to go home and get married and, you know, have a bourgeois life if they can afford it. And then at that point, the story is over and we need new different kinds of models to think about these kinds of infrastructures. But again, I would not take that as a reason to just dismiss that, because, you know, these things, the things we should be more critical about, that they do happen, and how can we avoid them? I don't think we can. We just need to be attentive and aware of that and try to intervene. And there are many stories in that historical case where really feminists took over because they had the women's movement before, and gay men who were affected, they just followed their lead. I mean, there's also these kinds of stories, and it's also about developing or telling these stories in order to make sure that next time it happens, maybe in this and that way.
Thank you so much for bringing care back into conversations, because it's dismissed way too often. In a lot of the circles where care is dismissed, people keep on talking about love as the answer. Kind of almost blind to the idea that we've put love into such a transactional process of accountability and reciprocity, because love demands immediate reciprocity, right? I love you, I love you back. And then the feedback cybernetic loop is over. But when it comes to questions of caregiving, we haven't really established where the cybernetic loop ends, because you always keep on thinking about you care it forward, right? So you receive care, and the presumption is that you will take it forward one step. So I really appreciate the fact that you're bringing community care back into conversation. And I have a specific question, drawing from East Asian, but particularly Taiwanese and Hong Kong, gay men studies done by Fran Martin. So Fran has an incredible book which studies the Tongchi community. And she says the problem with investments of care, and this is directly about where we put care into, she says the problem with investments of care in the life of queer men in East Asia is that all care is concentrated on one predefined moment of crisis, which is the crisis of coming out, right? Because the most precarious thing that a young cis gay man in Taiwan and Hong Kong faces is this moment of coming out, which is almost like your Hamlet moment of refuse thy father, deny thy name, and then I'm here, I'm queer, deal with it kind of a rhetoric. So you are without history, without networks, but also without the affordance of buying a new house or in a tiny space like Hong Kong, actually migrating somewhere where you can start afresh. Like there's no San Francisco or New York to run away to where things will get better. So she says it's a very strange idea that all care should be directed only at that one moment of crisis. And she says maybe we need to start thinking about investing care, at least with this queer community that she's studying, and saying the care should be invested in diffusing that moment of crisis. And she says there is a different register of coming out, which is actually letting in. It's not that same moment of confrontation where I'm here, I'm queer, deal with me, but expanding a slow-growing network of trust, of acceptance, of conversations and negotiations, which then requires a different kind of collective care-making. And I'm just curious if you could tell us more about where these kinds of collective care-making happens, so that we don't care about you only when you are in a moment of crisis, but we start providing you with care way before the crisis comes in, and that the moment of crisis is not the predefined script through which you are going to identify yourself as precarious.
The first example that comes to my mind is something that I've just started looking into, which is, you might argue, is in response to the crisis of unavailability of medical care in the U.S., but in some ways it's a very slowly unfolding crisis. So there are these two different kinds of digital, and maybe you have some ideas about these too. I don't know if I would call them communities, but places of interface. One is in the crowdsourcing of medical diagnosis. So there are websites where you can upload your medical data from your doctor's office, and then volunteers will compete to see who can come up with a diagnosis, and the prize will be, you know, 200 US. So many, many people, thousands of people perhaps, are working on your diagnosis, and someone will get, you know, the lucky ticket. And so is that a community? Is it care? It gets someone a medical diagnosis they can't otherwise afford. Another example is the way that undiagnosable illnesses create communities online because, again, a failure of access to medical care here because particularly syndromes that women caregivers get, which is another interesting phenomenon, right? So the work of giving care. So, for example, earlier we were talking about caregivers for people who have dementia or Alzheimer's disease. There's a new category for the kind of symptoms that a caregiver will develop. They call them secondary patients. So the work of care is so depleting that you yourself might become ill from taking care of someone else. I think that's really interesting as someone who's interested, again, in the political economy of care. Why is it women of color in particular, who are becoming afflicted by this secondary patient syndrome, right? So there are communities online for people to try to diagnose these things that don't have names because they're diseases that women of color get, so they don't have names. Again, in some sense, if you're actually interfacing with people online, perhaps it is something like a community, but the word community is difficult because it does have a history of something like identification, and you know, queer of color critique and women of color feminism have proposed models of coalition. So coalitions can be temporary, right? And they can be problem-focused. But I don't think coalition explains these digital collaborations either. So those are the examples that come to my mind, but maybe you have others.
So I found it interesting in your two comments there is this temporal aspect, or to think about these communities of care in a more continuous temporal way. So it's not about here I am, I'm coming out, here I am, deal with me, but it's more like a process and constant negotiations that also involves conflict, but maybe not exclusively conflict and also other modes of social interaction. And with the app and the crowdsourcing of diagnosis, it's also kind of a process that you can, that it's not just you hand it in and then you get your ticket, your diagnosis. I think it also connects to your comment. Do we talk about communities of care only in moments of questions of life and death? And I think it's constantly developing, and like you gave the examples, but we still, I think we could still develop a more apt vocabulary to really put that all together as something, for instance, what we call communities of care, because it's a continuous process. It can fail, but it is there, and it's more than just a coalition. It's sometimes forms a community. Sometimes it derives out of an existing community. Maybe it doesn't need to be that even. Politically or as an activist, I would call it counterpublic, which is also a different different concept that doesn't really fit to your examples. So yeah, I'm still looking for the right vocabulary, and we have some notions and concepts mentioned.
Was there anything over here?
I don't see, maybe behind your bag? No, it's not, nobody. Anybody?
Thank you. I just wanted to ask what you think about, because I think actually also the notion of care revolution, not only in the sense of, because I think that's a very important contribution of anti-racist Marxist feminism, to say that this that the underlining separation of production and social reproduction actually doesn't work. And I think the approaches in calls for care revolution very much show that, because it's not only a form of a care as a political relationality constrained to the domestic, but it goes beyond that. And I would like to, or it blurs even this separation. Yeah, it blurs in a way this dichotomy. And I was wondering if you could just, because I try to think more through care revolution, and I think there's also a very limited sense of how it is at least used here in the German sense, in the German context, because it's not really explicitly combined with questions of abolitionist justice, transformative justice, when it comes to carcerality and other forms of punishment, for example. And I would just like to know your thoughts on that. How can we can not even extend, but how we can further stretch care revolution into the direction of abolitionist justice.
So, I mean, the concept of care revolution, I mean, I assume you're referring to an event or a gathering, a congress that took place here in Berlin a couple of years ago. I don't know if any one of you were involved in that, and then it would be awesome to hear your comments on that and your experience from there, because I could not do that right now. But I can only agree to what you were saying, that we need to extend that notion. And it's even for our local situation so difficult, because we don't even have a word to describe that in German, right? To these. So if I start a revolution, I would like to know what it is about. It's about care, and it's not even translatable to people who are most of the people who are affected by it. But that's not a real answer. I don't know if you have a comment on that.
I don't think I know specifically your reference for the care revolution. Can you say a little bit more, and then we can think about abolition? Because I think that's a really important question.
confine this to the German context, but here the discussions around care revolution were then very much referring to the economization of the care sector and the privatization of the care sector, and they were not linked to from my perspective, not linked to the expansion of the security state. But only to the withdrawing of the welfare state. But this goes together in a way. So I'm just thinking if you have thoughts of how this is brought together in notion of abolitionist practice or transformative justice, because I think there's a lot of potential to work on this together.
Yeah. Do you have a response? Yeah. Can we?
I'd like to pass on the microphone, but it's difficult.
Yeah, so I would like to respond. Maybe I hope that it might respond in the German context. I think that three developments, the reproductive technologies such as gestational surrogacy, the increasing feminization of labor, of women coming into the labor market, and the increasing exploitation of migrant labor, have actually all part of the neoliberalism of the last 20 or 30 years, really undermined any kind of necessity of the nuclear family. And at least the way I've been observing it, the right-wing populism has gained huge appeal by redefending the family ideologically, saying that re-sacralizing the endangered family. And I think this moment of re-sacralizing the endangered family, of strengthening the nation and the state, getting the justification for doing that by resacralizing the family is something where maybe these things really, really come together in important ways that show just that it's not just care at home, it grows. and yeah, I don't know if that's something that helps.
I'm not sure if I understood you correctly, but were you suggesting that the role of the family is diminished and therefore right-wing populism is trying so hard to put it back to its original place? Because at that point I think I would disagree because the role of the family is unfortunately unchallenged and still at the center, especially in neoliberal societies that work always in this double sense of outsourcing and commercialization of care work, but at the same time of a familiarization of that work. The more precarious a nuclear entity like the family becomes, the more important it becomes for the family members to jump in where the state is leaving the spot, right? Is fleeing from its responsibility. So people who need care or work are increasingly dependent on family members. And this is the problem of that neoliberal of these current neoliberal policies, because they work in two seemingly opposing ways that actually are both damaging the social fabric.
I'm still thinking about the question of abolition. One thing I would say to the question of how to connect care economies to abolition is that,
Vanessa? Vanessa,
she's busy. No, I wanted to continue the conversation about abolition because it's such a fantastic question, and I was thinking about how, at least in the United States, which is the context I know best for the prison industrial complex, the prison system is a site that in some ways we could compare to the household as one where it's not recognized as a labor economy, but also in a way that's completely different from the household. It's multiply erased because these are people who we're from, you know, day one, encouraged ideologically to abandon socially, right? So a criminal is someone who you abandon socially, and yet the whole system depends on the state's failure to care for communities who then become criminalized and feed this economic system, right? A laboring system. So again, I don't know the event, the revolution of care, but I am really interested in how changing the political economies of care, including the project of abolition, would require a focus in many different parts of society on retraining our affects and who we care about, which is something we were talking about in the Nation context yesterday. I'm sorry, in the Nation panel yesterday in a very different context, which is where do we start doing this work of retraining ourselves about whom we should care for? And for me, that is the project of what a lot of abolition groups are doing, is trying to retrain, right?
Are you able to do a 2-minute summary as a sum up of the conversation? Me neither.
Maybe one more question if there's one, otherwise. Okay. Last remark?
I mean, I could ask you another question, a final question.
In 1 minute to answer. You can if you want.
Yeah? Because I'm interested because we haven't really talked about biocapitalism, which seemed to be, this is a whole new aspect, but biocapitalism, 1 minute.
1 minute, closing statement, biocapitalism.
Closing statement, okay. Because I was interested just whether that's if you're referring primarily to new biotechnologies and how it might involve concrete social relations, and how does biocapitalism work in the context of our discussion?
Well, I'll just go back to the context of the prison industrial complex, which isn't how I was thinking about biocapitalism. But the idea there is that we've been talking about the private space of the domestic as one that was never just in the home, but has been extended to a whole world economy of care. But it still has this characteristic of, we understand care work as devalued because it's feminized, it's often performed by racialized workers, right? Outsourced to low resource economies. So the discourse that this comes from biotechnology, that biocapitalism, the reliance of capitalism on life, bio, is something new, is something I contest. And if you look back at the origins of modern capitalism in the period of European territorial colonialism, you'll see that chattel slavery and indentured labor were the foundations of that economy. So it's always relied on the capture of life, right? Capitalism has done that. And I think that prisons are an excellent example of that, a form of capture that's evolved to inherit that history, but also connects very closely to this process of assuming that labor happens here in public where we can see it, and therefore we have to organize in response in public this way versus these unseen spaces that are erased because of race and gender. And that's not a capture of the whole conversation, but it hopefully answers your question a little bit.
It totally does, and I'm especially grateful for connecting it to the prison question.
Okay. So?
So I think we're not done, but we still
we'll pause
kind
here.
Of pause.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you all for the discussion.